Hi, this is Bill Mumy, and whether I'm lost in space or up there on Babylon 5, I know that Destiny's, the voice of science fiction, can be heard every Friday at 11:30 p.m. on 90.1 FM, WUSB, Stony Brook. Yeah!
This is George Takei of Star Trek, and whether I'm at the helm of the Starship Enterprise or captain of the Excelsior, I set my course for 90.1 FM, WUSB, Stony Brook, where every Friday at 11:30 p.m., Destiny's The Voice of Science Fiction takes you to the stars. Live long and prosper.
Good evening and welcome to Destinies. I'm Howard Margolin, and tonight the voice of science fiction brings you Volume 2, Number 57 of Christopher DeFilippis' The Flipside, and a digitally re-edited encore presentation of a short story last heard on our second anniversary special on April 30th, 1985. In addition, we have a Destinies debut soundtrack spotlight on Hans Zimmer's score for The Da Vinci Code, beginning with Dies Mercurii e Martius.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I'm Christopher DeFilippis, and this is The Flip Side. It's time for a new installment of authors you should be reading, but probably aren't. This time around, I'll be highlighting the work of Charles Stross. Trying to keep track of Stross and his work can be confusing, as he admits on his website, which says that Stross has so far sold 14 novels. But all these sales are recent, from 2001 on, and only 6 are in print so far. Which I guess is why I went from never having heard of Stross to seeing a large and diverse body of work spring up seemingly overnight. I've managed to get my hands on Stross's novel, The Atrocity Archives, and I now understand how he's made such a big and sudden splash. It's amazing what a fresh and entertaining read The Atrocity Archives is, because when you come down to it, Stross hasn't really created anything fundamentally new. His is a world we've seen in varying incarnations, where magical forces are governed by mathematical precepts. There are still rites and rituals and human sacrifices, but they have a scientific basis. And the so-called demons once conjured up by necromancers are now recognized as extra-dimensional beings. That's not to say that these beings won't still hurt you or possess you or try to eat you, but they can also be corralled and used if you have the proper Kabbalistic safeguards in place. Ensuring these safeguards is Bob Howard, who works for the super-secret British intelligence agency, The Laundry. Bob was conscripted into The Laundry when his computer programming skills proved a bit too advanced for comfort, as he says in the book.
As they later pointed out to me, applied computational demonology and built-up areas don't mix very well. I thought I was just generating weird new fractals. They knew I was dangerously close to landscaping Wolverhampton with alien nightmares.
After years of dull work as a Laundry IS tech, Bob has been approved for active duty in the counter-possession unit. His first field assignment brings him to America, where he has to make contact with a British expatriate professor working in California, and find out why the U.S. government won't let her leave the country. But what begins as a simple fact-gathering mission becomes more complicated when the professor is kidnapped by a Middle Eastern terrorist cell, working magic of a dangerous magnitude, magic of a kind last seen used by the Third Reich during the Second World War. It would be all too easy to compare the Atrocity Archives to other popular genre hits with similar premises, like The X-Files or Men in Black or Kolchak the Night Stalker. Granted, all deal with horror, government conspiracies, and the occult. But you'd be missing the mark, especially when it comes to the intelligence quotient. Part horror, part spy thriller, and liberally peppered with wry English humor, The Atrocity Archives pulls off the neat trick of being at once complex and breezy. The story is detailed and multi-layered, with plenty of obscure references and advanced tech talk. But for all that, it never loses its sense of immediacy or accessibility. Whether Stross is writing for laughs, shocks, or thrills, his prose is always pitch perfect. This is especially true when it comes to Stross's depiction of the inner workings of The Laundry. Where you often see the spy portrayed as a roguish outsider, Bob Howard presents a more realistic vision of the life of a secret government operative. Bureaucracy is endemic to all government agencies, covert or otherwise. And Stross captures it in all of its mind-numbing minutiae. The obsessive bean counting, the endless paperwork, the office politics, which can become especially grisly in The Laundry. In these respects, Bob could just as easily be working for the DMV as for a super-secret organization protecting the world from phantom threats. Finding humor in the banality of office life is nothing new for those in the Dilbert Reading cubicle set. Magic, zombies, and alternative realities are stock-and-trade workhorses of genre fiction. Yet Stross melds these familiar, and some might even say cliched, elements to create something wholly unique. The Atrocity Archives is a smart and clever book, brimming with interesting characters, humor, creativity, and weird, sophisticated fun. And if it's indicative of the rest of Stross's sudden and prolific body of work, he joins the ranks of authors that have made my shortlist. He should be on yours, too. Now, from the It Shouldn't Matter But It Does department, I know we're all avid readers, and we never judge books by their covers, but sometimes it's hard not to. It's kind of a silly observation to make on the radio, but the cover for the original Golden Griffin edition of the Atrocity Archives was positively beautiful. It appears abstract at first glance, but it perfectly captures the spirit of the book. Shadowy constructs and obscure machinations conspiring to open doors to the unknown. Sadly, the trade paperback edition released by Ace features cover art with no art whatsoever. Stross's clever irony and wry humor are reduced to a dumb sight gag, an endless expanse of office cubicles, populated by things like tentacles and explosions and spatters of blood. Apparently, it was designed to lure readers hungry for a supernaturally tacky episode of The Office. Things like this always bother me, but especially so in this case. Golden Griffin is a small press, and you normally don't see their books in stores. And since most people don't obsessively troll the internet like I do in search of the latest specialty house offerings, it's the mass market Ace cover that will form the impressions of casual bookstore browsers. If that cover was all I had to go by, I'd probably have passed on the Atrocity Archives, which would have been a shame. I wonder how many potential readers Strauss may have lost because of this. Dumb covers do a disservice to writers and readers alike. Luckily for Strauss, and for all of you listening, you have me to set you straight. Go out and buy the Atrocity Archives in whatever binding is most readily available. You'll be glad you did.
From the soundtrack of The Da Vinci Code, we heard The Paschal Spiral and Malleus Maleficarum, composed, arranged, and produced by Hans Zimmer. Next, we'll open the Destiny's archives as Gary Haleda and Ralph Sciano join me to perform one of the most unusual stories ever read on our show, Who's Cribbing? By Jack Lewis.
April 2nd, 1952. To Mr. Jack Lewis, 9026 219th Street, Queens Village, New York. Dear Mr. Lewis, we are returning your manuscript, The Ninth Dimension. At first glance, I had figured it a story well worthy of publication. Why wouldn't I? So did the editors of Cosmic Tales back in 1934 when the story was first published. As you no doubt know, it was the great Todd Thornberry who wrote the story you tried to pass off on us as an original. Let me give you a word of caution concerning the penalties resulting from plagiarism. It's not worth it, believe me. Sincerely, Doyle P. Gates, science fiction editor, Deep Space Magazine.
April 5th, 1952. To Mr. Doyle P. Gates, editor, Deep Space Magazine, New York, New York. Dear Mr. Gates, I do not know, nor am I aware of the existence of any Todd Thornberry. The story you rejected was submitted in good faith, and I resent the inference that I plagiarized it. The Ninth Dimension was written by me not more than a month ago, and if there is any similarity between it and the story written by this Thornberry person, it is purely coincidental. However, it has sent me thinking. Some time ago, I submitted another story to Stardust Scientifiction and received a penciled notation on the rejection slip stating that the story was, quote, too Thornberry-ish. Who in the hell is Todd Thornberry? I don't remember reading anything written by him in the 10 years I've been interested in science fiction. Sincerely, Jack Lewis.
April 11th, 1952. To Mr. Jack Lewis, 9026 219th Street, Queens Village, New York. Dear Mr. Lewis, read your letter of April 5th. While the editors of this magazine are not in the habit of making open accusations and are well aware of the fact in the writing business there will always be some overlapping of plot ideas, it is very hard for us to believe that you are not familiar with the works of Todd Thornberry. While Mr. Thornberry is no longer among us, his works, like so many other writers, only became widely recognized after his death in 1941. Perhaps it was his work in the field of electronics that supplied him with the bottomless pit of new ideas so apparent in all his works. Nevertheless, even at this stage of science fiction's development, it is apparent that he had a style that many of our so-called contemporary writers might do well to copy. By copy, I do not mean rewrite word for word one or more of his works as you have done. For while you state this has been accidental, surely you must realize that the chance of this phenomenon actually happening is about a million times as great as the occurrence of four Pat Royal flushes on one deal. Sorry, but we're not that naive. Sincerely yours, Doyle P. Gates, science fiction editor, Deep Space Magazine.
April 14th, 1952. To Mr. Doyle P. Gates, editor, Deep Space Magazine, New York, New York. Sir, your accusations are typical of the rag you publish. Please cancel my subscription immediately. Sincerely, Jack Lewis. April 14, 1952. To the Science Fiction Society, 144 Front Street, Chicago, Illinois. Gentlemen, I am interested in reading some of the works of the late Todd Thornberry. I would like to get some of the publications that feature his stories. Respectfully, Jack Lewis.
April 22, 1952. To Mr. Jack Lewis, 9026 219th Street, Queens Village, New York. Dear Mr. Lewis, so would we. All I can suggest is that you contact the publishers if any are still in business, or haunt your second-hand bookstores. If you succeed in getting any of these magazines, please let us know. We'll pay you a handsome premium on them. Yours, Ray Albert, President of the Science Fiction Society.
May 11, 1952. To Mr. Samson J. Gross, editor, Strange Worlds Magazine, St. Louis, Missouri. Dear Mr. Gross, I am enclosing the manuscript of a story I have just completed. As you can see on the title page, I call it Wreckers of 10 Million Galaxies. Because of the great amount of research that went into it, I must set the minimum price on this one at not less than 2 cents a word. Hoping you will see fit to use it for publication in your magazine, I remain, respectfully, Jack Lewis.
May 19th, 1952. Mr. Jack Lewis, 9026 219th Street, Queens Village, New York. Dear Mr. Lewis, I'm sorry, but at the present time, we won't be able to use Wreckers of 10 Million Galaxies. It's a great yarn, though, and if at some future date we decide to use it, we will make out the reprint check directly to the estate of Todd Thornberry. That boy sure could write. Cordially, Samson J. Gross, editor, Strange Worlds Magazine.
May 23, 1952, to Mr. Doyle P. Gates, editor, Deep Space Magazine, New York, New York. Dear Mr. Gates, while I said I would never have any dealings with you or your magazine again, a situation has arisen which is most puzzling. It seems all my stories are being returned to me by reason of the fact that, except for the byline, they are exact duplicates of the works of this Todd Thornberry person. In your last letter, you aptly described the odds on the accidental occurrence of this phenomenon in the case of one story. What would you consider the approximate odds on no less than half a dozen of my writings? I agree with you, astronomical. Yet in the interest of all mankind, how can I get the idea across to you that every word I have submitted was actually written by me? I have never copied any material from Todd Thornberry, nor have I ever seen any of his writings. In fact, as I told you in one of my letters, up until a short while ago, I was totally unaware of his very existence. An idea has occurred to me, however. It's a truly weird theory, and one that I probably wouldn't even suggest to anyone but a science fiction editor. But suppose, just suppose, that this Thornberry person, what with his experiments in electronics and everything, had in some way managed to crack through this time-space barrier mentioned so often in your magazine. And suppose, egotistical as it sounds, he had singled out my work as being the type of material he had always wanted to write. Do you begin to follow me? Or is the idea of a person from a different time cycle looking over my shoulder while I write too fantastic for you to accept? Please write and tell me what you think of my theory. Respectfully, Jack Lewis.
May 25th, 1952. Mr. Jack Lewis, 9026 219th Street, Queens Village, New York. Dear Mr. Lewis, we think you should consult a psychiatrist. Sincerely, Doyle P. Gates, science fiction editor, Deep Space Magazine.
June 3rd, 1952. To Mr. Sam Mines, science fiction editor, Standard Magazines Incorporated, New York 16, New York. Dear Mr. Mines, while the enclosed is not really a manuscript at all, I am submitting this series of letters, carbon copies, and correspondence in the hopes that you might give some credulity to this seemingly unbelievable happening. The enclosed letters are all in proper order and should be self-explanatory. Perhaps if you publish them, some of your readers might have some idea how this phenomenon could be explained. I call the entire piece, Who's Cribbing? Respectfully, Jack Lewis.
June 10, 1952. To Mr. Jack Lewis, 9026 to 19th Street, Queens Village, New York. Dear Mr. Lewis, your idea of a series of letters to put across a science fiction idea is an intriguing one, but I'm afraid it doesn't quite come off. It was in the August 1940 issue of Macabre Adventures that Mr. Thornberry first used this very idea. Ironically enough, the story title also was Who's Cribbing? Feel free to contact us again when you have something more original. Yours, Samuel Mines, Science Fiction Editor, Standard Magazines, Incorporated.
The reading of Who's Cribbing we listened to was actually the second version of the story we aired on our show. The first time, Fred Coulter and I read it without any background music or editing on April 10th, 1984, my fourth appearance on Destinies. It's a good feeling to finally have it air with today's production standards applied to it. In the background is Kyrie for the Magdalene, written by Richard Harvey, from the soundtrack of The Da Vinci Code, which opens in theaters on May 19th. Also on May 19th, we'll either shine the Destiny soundtrack spotlight on Joseph LaDuca's score for The Triangle and speak live via telephone with the composer himself, or we'll have a 54-year flashback on the Destiny's Radio Theater as we take you back to May 19th, 1952. Hey, that's one of the dates in Who's Cribbing, for a full-length adventure of The Lone Ranger. In 2 weeks, we'll salute the opening of X-Men: The Last Stand by interviewing Len Wein, co-creator of the new X-Men and editor of the unauthorized X-Men. Then on June 2nd, the Destiny's film review team will assemble live to discuss the third X-Men movie. As Destiny's 20s continue, listen for concerts by Sudden Death, the Brobdingnagian Bards, and Emerald Rose, Destiny's radio theater performances of Superman, Star Trek, and The Shadow, and interviews with Bear McCreary, Rob Esterhammer, George Takei, and Christopher Reeve. If you have any comments about our program or would like to request copies of this or any previous broadcast, you can write to Destiny's, care of WUSB-FM, Stony Brook University, Stony Brook, New York, 11794. Or you can call me at 631-632-6901, that's 632-6901, on Wednesday after 9 p.m. You can also send email to destinysvoice@aol.com, that's destinysvoice@aol.com. Destinies is produced by members and friends of the Science Fiction Forum in association with WUSB Stony Brook. The forum meets on Tuesday nights at 8 in room 029 in Harriman Hall on the Stony Brook University campus. To hear archived Destinies episodes, visit www.captphilonline.com. That's www.captphilonline.com. Until next Friday at 11:30 p.m., when we'll either enter the Triangle with Joseph LaDuca or return to those thrilling days of yesteryear with the Lone Ranger. For Gary Hileta, Ralph Sciano, and Christopher DeFilippis, this is Howard Margolin wishing you the best of all possible destinies.